All right, so what I'm going to do at this time is walk everyone through what is commonly called the 12 steps of the human act, or the 12 steps of a free choice. Now, already I have to make qualifications up front. They're not steps in a lockstep sequence. We're going to draw qualifications about that as we go. You could call them the 12 sub-acts of an overall human act. That would probably be a more apt description. The 12 sub-acts or constitutive acts of a human act. They're not 12 steps per se. They're 12 sub-acts of the human act. Okay? Now, the analysis that I'm about to give you is, we could say, standard or classic within the Thomist tradition. I was just talking with Father Michael Sherwin about who the first Thomist was to lay this out, and neither of us are certain about it. Maybe somebody else knows who the first was. But even if we don't know who the first was, it's so standard and so common in Thomist textbooks that you're going to come across it. So let's walk through it. And what it does is it lays out what's involved. It's a schema that lays out what's involved in the human act, and it's typically distinguished between two columns. And what we'll do is we'll go back and forth. Now, that already is going to give a kind of impression that there's this kind of back and forth, boom, 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 within the human person. And real life is not necessarily like that. There's a lot of temporal overlap, coinciding, cohering. There's all sorts of qualifications to make, but we'll just sort of make those qualifications in a general way, and then we'll go and lay out the steps, okay? All right, so the first, in order to make a free choice about anything, the first thing we need is an apprehension. I'm going to give you the one-word descriptions of these because I can spell them out verbally, okay? Usually this is called the apprehension of the end or the apprehension of the good, where apprehension of the end typically means the proximate end that's being pursued, but as we'll see, it also applies to the ultimate end, okay? So as we go along, I'm going to give an illustration with a practical case to sort of illustrate a free choice. So suppose a friend of yours comes up to you and says, hey, do you want to go to Paris? Okay? So, yeah, we have an apprehension. Someone up here in front is already shaking her head. Yes, apprehension, Paris, good. Okay? It just seems good. And that's an act in the intellect. Okay? Now, what typically we could say develops or forms in response to this is, we could call it volition. It's usually called simple volition, but I'm intent on one-word titles here as much as possible, okay? Simple volition, a movement of the will, an attraction. In English, contemporary English, we might call it a wish. It's that movement of the will where you want it, but it's not yet like you're going to it. So it's quite feasible that I could come up to you and say, hey, you want to go to Paris? You apprehend it as good, and basically at the same time or coinciding with it or inhering within the same response is a wish. Oh, yeah, Paris. And you have a wish for it, right? We all have many wishes. We all have many wishes, okay? From many different goods that are proposed to us in the concrete circumstances of life every day, either through the senses, external or internal, or through conversations, testimony, friends, events, etc. Okay? All right. Now, the next step or sub-act within the intellect is often called the judgment of possibility. I don't know how to do that in one word, so we'll just say J, possibility. Okay? The judgment of possibility. Now, possibility is a tricky word. And those of us who have studied contemporary philosophy have a certain, we could say, repertoire of standard distinctions. there's logical possibility, there's metaphysical possibility, there's physical possibility, various types. This is more like judgment of what? Personal feasibility. How feasible is the act for you to carry out, given all your other ends that you're in pursuit of? Okay? The human being as a free agent, remember, we're agents in pursuit of happiness. There's never a kind of point where you're outside that quest for happiness. So you and I are always already embedded in a web of pursuits. And as beings embedded in a web of pursuits, a new proposal like, hey, let's go to Paris, is either going to figure in well to that web of pursuits, or it's not going to figure in well into that web of pursuits. So you might say, well, gee, I've got to work, I've got to make money, or I'm in the middle of the school year, I've got to continue going to my classes, and other such considerations. You could form a judgment. It's just not possible, meaning it's not feasible. It doesn't figure in well to my broader field of ends, my broader web of ends. It just doesn't figure into that, okay? So what we could say is that the judgment of possibility is where wishes go to die, okay? they just don't figure into life, okay, that way, okay? But sometimes, from time to time, things go well and you can pursue your wishes, okay? And then you'd say, yeah, it is feasible, you know? I can afford it, it's a good time of the year, etc. So we are, I'm going to Paris, here we go. And in the will, you form the intention, okay? Intention. Now, we are gonna have a whole talk on intention. What is intention? Looking forward to it. So that's going to be something that we discuss. Now, once a person has an intention, you have, as we might say, a fixed end. What's the difference between a simple volition and an intention? The volition is a wish, but without commitment to pursue it. The intention is more like the wish combined with the commitment to pursue it, right? Something like that. I mean, I'm using the word commitment very, very, very broadly. Please don't overinterpret that. But it's like, it's you know what I mean. If you search your own experience, there's certain things that become more than wishes, but become actual pursuits. This is like an actual pursuit. Okay? We're going for it. We're going to Paris. Here we go. Okay? Now, sometimes these four steps or sub-acts are said to be, generally speaking, regarding the end, okay? Regarding the end. So this is about what end or what ends am I going to pursue, meaning particular ends, okay? And, but what we said earlier is, wait a second, we'll come back to this in a bit, the particular ends that we pursue, those themselves are very often means with respect to further ends, okay? That's a certain complexity that we'll just note for now, and we can discuss it later, okay? All right, but let's suppose we've settled on this pursuit. We're going to Paris. Now we undertake the steps regarding the means, and there are four of those on the traditional schema. The four steps regarding the means. The first is deliberation. That's something that takes place in the intellect, or by the intellect, okay? We can understand deliberation very broadly as the process of gathering various ways by which we might achieve the pursuit, or fulfill the pursuit, or arrive at the end that we have settled upon obtaining through intention, okay? So we might ask ourselves, well, great, we're going to Paris. How should we go? There's various ways we could get to Paris, okay? We could go by plane. We could go by cruise ship. And there are good aspects and bad aspects of the different ways we could go. Okay? So what would be good aspects of going by plane? Well, it's fast, or faster, and you're there, done in and out, okay? That's one good aspect. Cost is another thing to consider. I mean, I don't know what costs of flights are relative to cruise ships these days, but there's some element there. But are there good aspects and bad aspects of going by cruise ship? Yes, I mean, it's longer. That might be a bad aspect, but it might be a good aspect, depending on, you know, time and how much you want to linger. I mean, some people like a more relaxed journey. That might figure into your ends better. It might be more entertaining along the way to go on a cruise ship. We could play shuffleboard and drink mimosas and do things like this on the cruise ship. And those are good aspects, okay? So what happens is we go back and forth about this. And along the way, there's a... And notice I said along the way, not like next, but as you're doing it, there's this other act of the will that's called consent. And this is something, it has a slightly broader sense in the Thomistic understanding of things than we use it in contemporary society. We tend to use it to mean something like, you know, you sign a consent form before you go in for a surgery, like I'm saying yes to this. That's a much... this is a much, I guess, broader sense, where consent means like responsiveness to the various means. So do you accept these means? Or do you not accept this, or we should say batch of means? So you might, you know how it goes in your acts or your deliberations. You might say, yeah, we could go by plane, yeah, we could go by cruise ship, but actually neither of them seem very exciting. We want something really thrilling, right? Let's go by Zeppelin or something and see if we can go across the ocean that way. Okay, so you might reject the mean. You might reject the whole batch and say, oh, this is boring. This is for boring people, okay? So that would be kind of non-consent. But you see what's happening there? You're evaluating, but not evaluating intellectually. You're willfully, you're responding. Your loves or revulsions are responding to the batch, okay? And you can go back and forth, but if you settle upon a batch, okay, it's either going to be this. We're either going to go by cruise ship or we're going to go by plane, okay? Then what has to happen is we need to make a decision between them. So decision is where you settle upon one means over and against the other. Now, let's please notice, we've got to be careful how we say this. Sometimes we might jump and say, you make a determination of which one is best. And we don't necessarily do that, because a lot of times it's not clear which one is best. There's that, for starters. Things can be murky in the concrete about what's best. But we just settle upon one. Okay, in our intellect, we judge this is the one. Okay, you know what it's like often when there's a toss up. Okay, if there's a toss up, you can just settle on one. Okay, using intellect, you say this is the one. Okay, and then there is an act called election in the will. Election is kind of similar to selection, and that's basically a kind of act where the intellect, or I'm sorry, where the will takes one means, right? Elects a particular means following the decision in one respect, okay? And it's often said that if you want to understand free judgment here, 7 and 8, this is a librum arbitrium, like properly speaking, okay? The free judgment, okay? What's a free judgment? It's this act here, okay? I'm going to make a qualification in the moment, but please note I put this in brackets just to point out here's where you have, as it were, like what earlier I was calling opting, okay? Here's like the moment of opting, okay, for one over the other. It's not just an act of the will, please note. It's an act of the will and intellect together. It's because you've made a decision, or because the agent has made a decision and settled, this is the one way among the others I will pursue this end, okay? And the will accepts the decision, so to speak, along with it, okay, along with the decision, okay? Now, this is where things get really tricky, and we can have disputes among Thomists about now, does the election necessarily follow the decision? Does the decision coincide with the election? Is the will accepting the decision? There's a number of things that we can discuss there, and we can do that later. There's something else I want to point out. A lot of people have pointed out that steps, if I may put it, or acts 5 and 6 are not always necessary, because there are many things in life where there's really not more than one means to an end, okay? There's really only one way, okay? If you want to recover, or if you want to get rest, deep rest, you need sleep, okay? There's just one way to get rest, and that is to go to sleep. So we don't deliberate about, you know, sleeping versus other modes of going to, you know, getting rest, okay? We go with it. So there you bypass 5 and 6, okay? All right. So these 4 steps, 5 through 8, and I admit I've gone through them quickly, we can discuss them. They're said to be regarding the means, okay? Then there's another batch of 4 steps that are said to be regarding execution, okay? So let's suppose we've deliberated about the means. Do we want to go by plane, or do we want to go by cruise ship? We've made our decision. We just want to get there and get back. So let's go by plane. That's the best. We elect that. Okay, now there's an intellect, a command of the intellect. Okay? Like, do it. Get a plane ticket. Okay? That's the act of the intellect. And then there's a corresponding movement by the will that begins to literally move the powers of the soul, to put all the powers of the soul into action. So you go to your computer, you go on the airline website, you look up flight times, etc. You start to use the powers of the soul. Okay? St. Thomas says that the will moves all the powers of the soul. He has in mind the cognitive and appetitive powers. He knows you can't move your nutritive powers. Okay? You can't make your liver do this or that. But the other powers you can. Okay? Now, suppose we do this. The intellect makes its command. We get our plane ticket. We hop on the plane. We fly over to Paris. We begin doing our thing there, etc. There's going to come a moment, and there, at least commonly in life, when we say to ourselves, or we ask ourselves, was this a good idea? I mean, how's it going? Did this go well? And then you make what's called the judgment of fruition. Okay, to use the traditional language. In other words, did this make you, I don't want to say make you happy, but was it fulfilling? Was it satisfying? Was it as good as it first seemed when you were back here at stage 1 or step 1, that kind of thing, okay? And there are some times in life when the judgment of fruition turns out pretty good, and we say, yeah, this was great, this was awesome. And what's happening at that point is the person is experiencing, we could say, fruitio, joy, satisfaction, delight, okay? Not joy in the sense of gaude. I don't know. I mean, we could talk about what fruitio means exactly. It's an interesting thing, fulfillment of some kind, okay, of the will. But we also know that there's times when we might say, this is horrible. Why did we do this? This was a major mistake, right? And then the judgment of fruition is to the contrary. It's not good. And then this, as it were, doesn't quite develop, okay? We could say, or at least a positive fruitio, okay? All right, those are the steps regarding execution, it's called. So remember earlier I was talking about the inner executive? The inner executive, that experience only captures, we could say, the last part of human action. And that only comes into play after there's been consultation of one's loves, really, reasons and loves in these previous steps. And without the operation of reason and those loves, we wouldn't even get to the execution level, okay? We wouldn't even get there. And a lot of actions begin here, and they don't just die at the judgment of possibility. They could also die further down the road. They could die here at the level of deliberation. Because you might say, well, wait a second, there's just no good in it, at way to get this end. Now, whoever wills the end wills the means, and there's just no good means available, then we could go back and give up on the intention, you see? So I want to stop here for a moment and make a qualification that, like I said earlier, we don't just go boom, 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 back and forth. Life is not that easy, okay? And we don't have that kind of, like, algorithm for like, our moral lives. This is not an algorithm. It's not a computer program or a decision procedure or something like that. It's a kind of clarification of the various sub-acts of intellect and will that are involved in an overall human act or free choice. And we all know that in real life, we can go back and forth between these things and skip back and forth. They happen in a way that is swirled up and swirls around and whirls around within us. So we can start out with the best of intentions, come to deliberation, realize there's no good means here, so go back and take back our intentions, okay? Or, and this is more significant, we might say second guess, or another way to put it would be we can reconsider. At any one of the steps along the way, the intellect is able to reconsider and to consider things under a different aspect. So you might start out saying, Paris, yes, that's awesome. Beautiful city, Eiffel Tower, all that stuff. And you have a wish for it. You make a judgment of possibility. You set out on the intention. But then you just realize, oh, wait a second. Aren't there riots going on in Paris right now? Wait. So then you reconsider. And you might go back a level, okay? So that's the way that real life actually works. It's not just a straightforward thing. It's a back and forth, okay? And at what it is, one of the things, I guess you could say, that accounts for the freedom of our free choices is that at any step of the way, intellect is able to reconsider what's proposed and see it under a different aspect, okay? Intellect at any step of the way can reconsider and look at things under a different aspect. And that's why we hold each other accountable or responsible for what we do, okay? If a person says, you know, why did you drink and drive, you know? I mean, you went out, you were drinking, then you were driving around, and you end up hitting this person and killing this person. Why did you do that? We expect the person to have these sorts of reasons. Now, it's more complicated when intellect has been impeded in some way by intoxication. But we can say, how come you didn't have a plan beforehand? Did you know you were going to drink? Did you plan it? Did you have a strategy for driving otherwise? We expect people to be able to give reasons for what they do. Okay. This also shows that each one of our volitions is not just kind of an arbitrary thing out, an arbitrary movement of the will. All the movements of the will, remember, are in response to a preceding act of the intellect. Okay? There are no Sartrean choices, like a criterionless or a reasonless movement of the will. Everything is in response to a reason. Every choice you make is in response to a reason. Now, some people will try to counterexample that and say, well, what if I'm just walking down the street kicking a pebble? And we could even build a kicking a pebble for no good reason. Isn't that just an arbitrary thing? Well, wait a second. Isn't there some kind of passion that's being satisfied by doing this? And what can happen is that the passion itself can be raised to the level of the reason why you do it. So we can act on passions. We can make passions our reasons, so to speak. And we can forget what reason itself tells us with its higher knowledge. And that's what St. Thomas says is the root of all sin or the root of all moral wrongdoing. The root of all sin is the forgetfulness of the norm of reason governing the act, where you just act on a passion without regard to principles that we might know in the back of our mind, okay, or have habitual knowledge of. So each thing has its each choice has its reasons. It's a work of reason and will together. There's no arbitrary or reasonless choices. Okay. Another thing to point out is a lot of people will look at this and say, wait a second, this doesn't capture my experience at all. And most of the time, I'm going through the day on the basis of routine. You might say, well, my job starts at a certain time, so I have my morning ritual. I get up out of bed, I do my morning ritual. You know, you shower, you get dressed, you head out the door at a certain time. Coffee's part of the ritual, probably. You head out the door at a certain time. You hop on the train. You know this train's going to be at this station at this time. You hop on. You go to work. You go to this desk. This person's going to be next in the desk next to you. You say hello. You sit down. You open up your computer. So now the first, hour and a half of your day can be pretty mindless, okay? But then someone say, well, wait a second. Wasn't every single one of those things a free choice? I mean, I didn't go through all these steps all the time, okay? What's going on there? What's going on is that you're following habitual intentions, okay? Habitual intentions that were formed by a preceding choice. And habitual intentions call for, habitual courses of action, and that's what's basically going on. So a great deal of our, daily life is us following habitual intentions and taking up habitual ways of getting them. And we're not going through this process, which with each and every particular act, but rather what's happening is that our daily actions are manifesting or expressing this this procedure, I guess you could say, or these steps that were made at a previous stage, okay? Because otherwise, you think, if we have to go through every single one of these, every single time you want to do something trivial like brush your teeth or go to the bathroom or something, that would be incredibly complex, okay? Life would be very complicated. So we live by habitual intentions, okay? Which is itself something to think about in terms of the moral life. We can cease to pay attention. And we can cease to pay attention to what we're doing. And we can become negligent in various ways due to that kind of momentum that the moral life gets due to habitual intentions and actions, okay? I think these qualifications that say these things do not happen in terms of an algorithm, but they're kind of swirling inside of us all the time. We go back and forth. We jump around. Sometimes they coincide. Sometimes they're stretched out over long periods of time. Like Augustine's Confessions, in some way, can be read as one long instance of this, okay? He's trying to determine, am I going to be a Catholic? Am I going to become a celibate monk? Okay, and then he agonizes over these things. And there's various things, difficulties he has up here, and then there's difficulties he has here, okay, at different points throughout. You can read the Exodus story of the Old Testament, the movement from slavery in Egypt to the Promised Land. You can read all of that very deeply if you bring this to bear on the text, okay? So here comes the proposal. Let's go to the promised land. Sounds good. But how are we going to get out of here? Pharaoh's got, okay, we'll take care of that. 10 plagues. Now we're done, okay? Now we're on our way out, okay? So now we're going, what's the way? What's the route we're going to go? We want to go this way. Yeah, but now what comes up? Oh, we're thirsty. Oh, we're hungry. We don't will these means anymore. Okay, let's go back to Egypt, some of them say. Forget that intention. Well, it's better to go back. And they just says, no, stop, stop. Reconsider. It was bad back in Egypt. Remember? You were slaves. Oh, yeah. Okay. So what are we going to do? Here's water from the rock. Okay. We've taken care of that problem. Now let's keep going. Okay? You see, everything can be read. Human action and agency can be read in light of these. If you learn to bring it to bear in an intelligent way on things, okay? And not look at everything so, as it were, mechanistically, okay? When you take into consideration that we often act habitually based on habitual intentions and habitually sort of determined courses of action, then the whole thing becomes even more realistic to our daily psychology, okay? There's just one last thing I want to point out. I'll use the other board. Just one last thing I want to point out, and then we can open it up for discussion. A lot of times when we think of free action or free choices, we think of that process of opting, like I talked about earlier. Like here's this picture of, here's the agent, and he can go this way or this way, okay? This way of thinking about things comes up particularly when you think in those discussions, when you're involved in those discussions regarding whether we have free will and the possibility of doing otherwise is often construed as a very criterion or a sign of free will, etc. Alternative possibilities, all those sorts of discussions. You can start to think of the moral life as basically, here's a timeline, and then I can go this way or this way, I can go this way or this way, but if I go this way, I can go this way or this way, and this way or this way. Okay? This is all like construing things in terms of the agent as an efficient cause without like an ultimate final end. And it's just like one act after another. Okay? Sergey Pinkers uses the example of like stitching on a when you sew something, right? You just here's a stitch, here's a stitch, here's a stitch, here's a stitch. But like it's just one thing after another. Okay? But that's not how our moral life is lived. It's not just one thing after another. In fact, the picture is more like, here's me, and I always already have, I mean, from the first moment that God stirs within me, I have this longing for happiness. That's there. That's fixed. That's done by nature. You cannot not want that, okay? You could be accidentally impeded by incidental circumstances, but per se, you and I want that, okay? Then the whole question is, we're not going to go there by instinct alone. The animals pursue their ends by instinct alone. But human beings do not pursue our end by instinct alone. We have instincts, but in addition to instincts, we pursue the end by choice. We make our way by choice, which means we want to find the ways. Eaque sunt ad finem, the ways, that which is for the sake of the end. And we are deliberate over the ways as we go. Okay. Now, again, earlier I said we have this, happiness is a complex end. There's a number of things involved. Okay. And, including ourselves as formed or shaped in a certain way, okay? So a certain character, a certain set of virtues is part of what I want, at least if we think about it carefully, okay? And then when it comes to the ways themselves, what are the ways we're going to take up to get our final end, our happiness? The ways themselves are all subject to this like judgment of possibility and deliberation. So when I'm picking out one way to an end, like let's see, In order to be happy, I want to become educated. In order to be educated, I want to go to school. Okay, so there's school. And that's for the sake of education. And that might be for the sake of career, cultural participation, etc. There might be more than one end. For this. You might want for the sake of career, for the sake of cultural participation, for the sake of self-awareness. But you also want probably something like financial stability. And that is going to modify, well, how big of loans are you going to take out on your school? And how is that going to affect which school you choose? Which schools have the highest tuition? How's that going to figure in with a financial stability story? So what happens is that we assess at any one point in time the means or the ways in light of further particular ends that we have. And those further ends are themselves means to still further ends, often. Okay? Unless you're talking about things that are simply ends. Okay? Then they'll be constitutive of that in some way. Okay? So you see what's happening is we're assessing ways in terms of ends. This is what leads people to say things like, the end justifies the means. We could say the temptation or the proclivity would probably be the better way to say it. The proclivity or the propensity to think that ends justify the means is somehow written into the very structure of free agency, because free agency is the evaluation of means in light of ends. But what can happen then is we become confused about what makes something to be really good. Okay? Is it good just because it's useful to an end I just happen to have? Or is it good because of further reasons? Like about the kind of being I am, what's going to actually bring me to perfection, etc. And what can happen is we end up taking a short-term view instead of a long-term view. But you will find Thomistic textbooks that say things like the ultimate end justifies the means. Meaning, the ultimate end and the true ultimate end, total integral happiness, that does justify the means. Okay? And there are certain means that cannot be good given what ultimate happiness is, given the conditions for integral ultimate happiness for human beings. Okay? And those things that cannot be justified, those ways or means that cannot be justified or evaluated as positive, in light of the true ultimate integral end, those are the intrinsic evils. Okay? Those are the intrinsic evils. Now, all I did was give you kind of a definition of intrinsic evils and those kinds of things. I'll leave it to others to spell all that out in great detail. Okay? But this allows us to then come, this picture over here allows us to come back here and say, there's a certain, you have to look at this picture here, the 12 steps or the sub-acts of a human act, in light of this picture over here, that each particular act, each time I go through these 12, that is embedded within a life story of various quests that one is on. Okay? To think of a human being, though, as standing back from all quests and saying, now why should I be a good person? Why shouldn't I just do what I want? And as soon as you ask that question, what you're showing or what you're revealing is that you're back to the sophist anthropology. I've got my appetites. I've got this power. Why shouldn't I just use my power to satisfy my appetites and just forget moral principles altogether? That's basically, you're back in a sophistic picture of a human anthropology. The Thomist answer is, you, as a human being, are made for this ultimate end, happiness. You cannot not want it. You will be happy precisely to the extent that you live in accord with reality as your reason perceives it. and you'll become unhappy according to the way you act contrary to reality as your reason perceives it. Okay? That's the gist of the answer, okay? Now, if you ask the next question, which is, well, prove to me that acting in accord with reality as reason perceives it, prove to me that the just life is better than the unjust life, that's a big question, and all I can say is go and read Plato's Republic. That's the question, okay? All right, so we'll leave it at that. Father Thomas Joseph.
This is not a pedagogical question. This is a naive question. I'm wondering about your how flexible is the notion of consent as you read it? Because if I could give just examples from Paris.
Yeah.
You take the intellectual millionaire and you take the intellectual indigent graduate student. The intellectual millionaire could think about all the ways to go, you know, the crude system advantages, and then you could go to the enterprise before and also see somebody, you know, Berlin and whatnot. So the thing is that you have a very, and so you get kind of paralysis.
Yeah.
Where making decisions is very difficult. That's where the graduate student says, well, Norwegian Airlines is $300. So it starts at 53, it goes up. And so it definitely, that's the way.
Right.
And so both of them consent, so they're both deliberating, but it seems like the graduate student goes to the decision really quickly, and then the other one is like has to make a decision despite the fact that he can't quite consent to any of the means.
Yeah.
And I guess what I'm wondering is, my question is, am I understanding correctly in this sense? Consent is like the exploration in love of the deliberative means, so that I'm thinking about how much I love or wish this or that means. And then seeing about, in light of the judgment of the possibility,
yep.
I finally make a decision. So for some people, it's always there. But sometimes that consent is rather open-ended because I need to just make a decision because I have so many.
Yeah.
And in other cases, I consent in part because of the narrowing. And when I deliberate, in light of the judgment of the possibility,
right.
the deliberation becomes very narrow to deciding the easy.
Right.
Am I on the right track?
Yeah, that seems right. The more resources a person has available, the more means are available, the more deliberation there is to do. Whereas if a person doesn't have all those available to them, there's just less deliberation to do up front. That seems right to me. But I think you also see that the judgment of possibility is a kind of background assessment of your overall condition and overall ends and means, yeah, the ends that you're in pursuit of, and resources available.
I have more questions, but I'm going to let others
ask. Yeah. Just before we jump into that question, I think that your way of thinking about it, Father Thomas Joseph, is good and right, because you're looking at these things not so much as just one thing we carry out after another, but they're somehow always there in our free agency. These sub-acts are always kind of at work. Okay.
Right, the judgment of possibility is casting a light underneath which you're doing the other things. It doesn't go, you don't do it and then it goes away. It's more like it's like a hierarchical light coming down into the later acts.
Yeah. That seems right to me. Okay.
Thank you for the second talk. My question goes back to the first talk, but it relates to the material here. If I'm not mistaken, I think you said that Aquinas sometimes called the intellect a formal cause of the will and sometimes a final cause of the will.
Yeah.
I can understand how the intellect would be a formal cause of will. You know, it apprehends that this object is a particular good and the will is directed toward it. But if the will is already naturally inclined to the good in general, then...
It's good. It's inclined to the perceived good.
Okay, the perceived good in general. Then how is intellect a final cause then?
I think, well, the answer would be it's inclined because of what goodness is. Goodness is attractive. Goodness is magnetic. That's the definition Aristotle gives at the beginning of the Nicomachean Ethics. The good is that which all desire. And... Survey of Pinkeris helpfully glosses that by saying Aristotle's defining goodness in terms of its property. It exercises attraction upon us. Now, Father Michael Sherwin wants to say something too.
He just described it. We have to remember, rather than neither Aristotle nor Aquinas intended to define goodness, the definition
depended upon
genius.
Yeah. Yep. Right, but the manifestation of goodness is through its attractiveness. Yeah.
So my question has to do with the relationship between the first four steps and the next four steps. Because, I mean, like, 1 through 4 and 5 through 8, because... Okay.
You mean like treating these as wholes?
Taking those four steps, and because you said that the first four had to do with the end and the second next four had to do with the means.
Yep.
So my question is, I'm a little concerned because since every end except for the final end is itself a means, you would think that we should just apply to every end except the final end steps 5 through 8, which makes steps 1 through 4 redundant, or at least not clearly applicable, or at least having competing explanations. And it seems with respect to the final end, we have that by nature, so we don't need 1 through 4. So the question is, what are 1 through 4 doing?
You're looking at it in the abstract. In the concrete, circumstances make a huge difference. And first of all, is there more than one way to approximate end? That's all. That's going to, as it were, decide certain matters for us. And other circumstances about resources available for pursuit and whatnot. So every free choice is by a concrete agent, in circumstances, in response to ends that you intend. Okay. I think when you consider it in the concrete, you can see all kinds of daily examples of these things, and that's what it's meant to spell out for you. Looking at it in the abstract, like. The ultimate end is undecided, and everything else is it not a matter of deliberation if it's necessary or something?
Well, it's just that, like, since every other end is itself a means, it seems like if 1 through 4 are supposed to explain how we arrive at taking that as an end, then that should just be the same story as how we take that as a means to some further end. In other words, we should just be applying steps 5 through 8. With respect to further ends, right?
Oh, I see. Yes, I do. That I was hinting at that earlier on in the talk when I said this, in fact, because of this embedding business over here, this is really like another form of this going back a step back. And Aquinas knows about that.
Yeah.
And he talks about how there's deliberation preceding deliberation, and you have to come at some point to first intentions and the intention of happiness.
Okay,
and so some things are we intend by nature, the five natural inclinations, and things like that.
So would you say then, am I understanding correctly, that steps 1 through 4 and 5 through 8 are really, these are the same acts. They're just, it depends on whether you're viewing it from one side or another side, so to speak.
With respect to an approximate end or whether you're viewing it with respect to an ultimate end.
Okay, excellent.
Right,
thank you.
Yeah. So those distinctions make a difference, yeah. There's a way in which this judgment of possibility is kind of like decision. There's analogies. Yeah, you can look at that.
Thank you for your talks. My question goes back to the first part of this talk.
Okay. You mean the earlier session?
Yeah, the earlier session. We were talking about how the truth is the object of the intellect, and how in today's society, with the relativism that's present, people want to separate truth from the intellect and separate truth from
goodness.
From goodness and the search for those things. So my question is, what exactly are they doing when they separate truth from goodness? What are they going, like, what is their end?
I think,
and how is that even possible if it's so much part of our nature to search for the truth?
Good question. I think that by nature, they're still human beings and they're still in pursuit of the good. They just have profound lack of self-awareness or self-understanding. And there's just a lot of errors in the intellect. To say that there's no truth about the goodness or we don't know what the truth about the good is, they're just in error about that. And they're still, in fact, pursuing goods that they're making judgments on all day, right? They're going to go to a restaurant, you know, search for a life mate, etc. Those are all, they're pursuing ends. And they're making choices in regard to do so, but there's just a profound self-unawareness and probably confusion and disorientation as a result. Another part of the story, I'll just say it quickly, is that a big, crucial part of the story about the how we know the truth about the good is that we know the truth about the good not just by philosophical exercises. Few people will know the truth about the good through philosophical exercises. Most people know the truth about the good because of something Aquinas calls synderesis and conscience. And everybody's got that. That can be more or less developed in different people. So even if a person is in principle a relativist and a nihilist or something like that, there will come moments when synderesis kicks in and say, wait a second, that's not fair. You just made a moral evaluation. You made a moral judgment.
Okay. Thank you, Brother, for your talks. I had a question also about the first part. I was wondering if you could say a little bit more about what you mean by capacity when you talk about free will being a capacity.
Yeah.
Compared to a power?
Yeah, so capacity is kind of a sneaky term because St. Thomas does use it a lot. But in the analysis of human nature, there's a finite number of terms of the analysis. If you go all the way back to not just what is a human being, but what are the terms of the analysis of what a human being is. In the terms of the analysis, you've got a finite number of things you can appeal to. You can appeal to something as either a principle, it's a potency, an act, an object, an end, okay, or a property. Those are the terms of the analysis. And a lot of people have objected to the Thomas's account of human nature on just this grounds that the terms of the analysis are too constrictive, okay? But in fact, there's more terms in his way of thinking about human beings than just those. And capacity is one of them. So our capacity for the truth, for example, human beings are capax veritatis, he'll say that. There's more to being capax veritatis than just having an intellect. Intellect is like the primary and per se act by which you know truth. But in order for truth, in order to know truth through the intellect that way, the other powers of the soul need to be working in various ways. Imagination's got to be working, memory's got to be working, cogitative power's got to be working. And if those powers are impeded in some way, the capacity for truth can be compromised, even if the power of the intellect is still functioning, okay? So likewise, a free choice, you could say it's a capacity. It's capax, meaning it's an ability. If you want to look at it in terms of the predicables, it would be a property. I think it would be the order of a property, okay? Something proper, an attribute proper to human beings, okay, in the order of action, in the category of action, okay? That's what the librum arbitrium is. Yeah, I know, as soon as we start to use words besides power, potency, act, the usual ones. But if you do a word search on capacity in Aquinas, it's all over the place. This is why I don't like that Thomistic literature that just uses power and capacity synonymously. A number of contemporary Thomists do that. Say, we don't like power talk, it's archaic, let's use the word capacity. Whoa, capacity is kind of a technical term in Aquinas. Yeah.
I'm thinking about sin and how it seems like all these sub-acts could be corrupt at any one point. My question is, do you think it's fair to actually pinpoint within steps where actual corruption of the will takes place, because it seems like sin actually had, you know, like you said, the root of evil is in a misapprehension of the good. But when you speak of sin, we talk about an evil will. So how does
right,
that
if you want to find the roots of sin, I wouldn't look to this right away. I'd go to the powers, go back to intellect and will. And there's multiple, Aquinas has multiple things to kind of account for. First of all, there's bad habits, okay? Whether vice or incontinence or something like that. There's bad habits. And Aquinas works with all the principles Aristotle has, that as a man is, so the good seems. So if there's bad habits in either the passions or in the will, evil is going to seem good to the intellect. And good is going to seem evil. The mean is going to seem extreme, and the extremes are going to seem good, to use virtue talk. So that's one way things can get introduced. But also one way that error can be introduced, or that choice can be corrupted. There's also mixed concept of mixed motives. That's a whole other thing, where you have both two motives for doing something, one that's good, one that's bad but seems good. There's various combinations. That can be corruptive or imperfect. There's the effects of the fall, where the will loves, where because of the fall, one loves oneself more than God. And so there can be a self-seeking quality about things. There's a corruption in the will that way. There's the wounds of original sin that keep the passions unruly and makes it harder to acquire virtue. So there's various factors he has in his philosophy and theology to account for the very general notion of corruption. Okay, but there is one thing he does say, that when it comes to the act and making bad acts, the bad act is rooted or accounted for by forgetfulness of the norm or the truth that applies to the act. And that forgetfulness, inattentiveness, or ignorance can be due to any one of these other circumstances at work.
Thank you.
How about right here? Just because the mic is closer.
Thank you so much. I think I need to talk to you about planning a trip to Europe this summer.
Yeah.
So I work a little bit in the ancients, a little bit on moderns.
Okay.
And I was particularly 19th century stuff, and I was struck in your earlier presentation than just now when you discussed the sophistic anthropology.
Yep.
And said that's what he's arguing against. And when you were explaining,
it's kind of a, yeah, it's by contrast.
Yeah, by contrast. And I was struck the way you were explaining it, that it sounds quite a bit like Bentham and Mill. And so I wondered why, you know, what distinctions you might draw between a Benthamite anthropology or a Millian anthropology and a sophistic anthropology,
yeah,
as you presented it, whether you would draw any distinctions and sort of...
I'm not so sure. Personally,
mm-hmm,
I'm not so sure I would.
Okay. All right.
I do think that there's a recycling of sophistry,
mm-hmm,
down through history. Plato himself thought that. If you read...
I'm glad to hear this.
It's a serious proposition. If you read the... is it the Parmenides, where he talks about the two camps, the friends,
mm-hmm,
of the forms and the earthbound giants? The friends of the forms believe in basically form and finality. The earthbound giants believe that whatever is composed of matter and things come about by chance. And they have a certain ethic that goes with it. And Plato says between these two camps, there is perpetual and undying warfare.
That's my dissertation.
He thinks that's written into, like, the humans, we could say the human situation or human condition. He might, I don't know if he'd say human nature, but that there's this, like, two cities. Okay? Even, like, Plato saw that. I think that distinction might be behind the two cities thing in Augustine. I'm not sure, but yeah, I don't think that there's many positions today that are that all that different from the sophist. So one thing you could do is spend some time reading Nietzsche, and then go read Plato's Gorgias. And when you sit them down next to each other, you'll see the major positions of Nietzsche have all been anticipated by Gorgias. I mean, power might makes right the whole thing. It's there.
Yeah, thank you, Father. So I have a question about how reconsidering fits into the various steps, and it seems to fit in maybe a few different steps. And I'm wondering your thoughts about, like, when you do reconsider, do you, like, go back to certain steps in particular?
No, I think you can reconsider at any point. Like,
any point.
I gave one example. Let's go to Paris. Oh, that sounds great. So at first you apprehend it.
Yeah.
Then you say, wait a second. I just heard on the news this morning there's riots going on. So you don't even get to, like, the judgment of possibility. Just an alternative consideration can kill the wish.
Okay, great. Yeah, and then I had a follow-up question on that. So then the act of reconsidering,
yep,
can that act itself be understood in terms of these 12 steps?
Yeah, so you can run this through, like, should I even think about this
right.
matter? Well, do you want to think about it?
Right.
I mean, this will happen. I mean, I don't want to use a horrible example, but think of a wife who suspects her husband is having an affair. And one of the things she has to do is, like, ask, am I even going to entertain the question? Because as soon as you entertain the question, everything takes on a new interpretation, and trust is breached. And I mean, so even the question of, like, am I going to consider that whether my husband is cheating on me is something that can be seriously considered, and it might not figure into a whole host of good intentions that she has, or whatever the case may be.
So would you say that it's a potentially infinite amount of reconsider? You can reconsider your reconsiderations, and I mean, it doesn't seem like a problem, because I mean, at some point you just wouldn't do it.
Could a person live in a state of continual deliberation?
Yeah.
you just wouldn't act beyond that.
Yeah. Okay. And then I guess that just relates to a broader question of how to individuate actions, because it seems, all of these can be seen as their own action or going to
these
the
are yeah
steps,
these
or,
think of these as like imminent acts that take place within the person. Then there's the activities like of the external powers, or kind of transitive acts and whatnot. That's where this comes, and they flow out of the use of the powers. As for what specifies an action and specifies it or makes it to be the kind of action it is, for that you need to go into the sources of the human act, or the sources of the moral act, object, end, and circumstances. And those, when you get into the nitty-gritty about those, which I didn't deal with here, but we will over the rest of the conference, the short answer to your question is that the species of an act is determined by object, end, and circumstances. Now, if you press that and say, well, what makes it to be the object and what makes it to be the end, that's two big talks we're going to have, okay? The act on intention and the act on object. And I'll let others answer those questions.
Great.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Hi, thanks again. So I'm trying to integrate your remark that where you see kind of the free will into the picture is in 7 and 8. I'm trying to integrate that kind of remark with also what you were saying before about there being a certain kind of wiggle room in the intellect with respect to aspects of the good. You can always consider some other aspect.
Yep.
So, like, intuitively, so let's go with, like, I'm in the stage of roughly deliberation, and I'm thinking about, am I going to go with Norwegian?
Right.
Am I going to go with Lufthansa?
Right.
And I guess something, you know, I might think is, well, you know, I've kind of narrowed down the range of options to those two, and so here comes decision. It's going to pick, let's say, Norwegian in this case. And that's where free will enters. I could have chosen arbitrarily. I could have chosen Lufthansa, but I went with Norwegian. But I guess earlier it sounded more like the kind of place where I could have done otherwise or could have done differently was somewhere in the stage of deliberation. So, for example, the aspect of the good that I'm considering, you know, when I go with Norwegian is something like, you know, it's $300, you know, I'm a graduate student, I can't afford anything beyond that, but, you know, also it's going to be, I'm going to be scrunched the whole time, I'm kind of a tall guy, so I want some room to spread out.
Right.
And when I can make an those considerations, I might lean towards a different way or consent to a different range of options. So could you maybe like comment on like, are we kind of saying like it's both of those things, or is it perhaps one or the other that makes it so that I could do something differently?
I think the ability to reconsider or consider other aspects is all throughout, like
I see.
These. Yeah. You could reconsider up here.
Hmm.
You can reconsider here at 3, 1, 3, 5.
Could you give me an example of how, so I'm seeing like my example, I think it's where I'm reconsidering, I'm entering some new maybe premises
sure.
into deliberation.
Sure.
Could you give an example of how I might reconsider at the level of apprehension?
Yeah, so I gave one earlier, which is someone says, let's go to Paris.
Okay.
At first you apprehend it as good, and then someone says, wait, I just saw on the news this morning that that there's riots going on.
Yeah.
And now the apprehension just ceases to seem good. And you don't even start deliberating how you're going to get there before you even get to that.
I see.
Now, someone might say, actually, that's at the level of judgment and possibility. You think it's unfeasible to go hang out in a city with riots. But it's like you didn't even get to that point, it seems.
Yeah. Can I ask just one follow-up? Is that
yeah.
too much? Okay. So the way
yeah,
you're describing it there, I guess I thought volition is kind of what's saying what you apprehend. Let's say volition says, hey, that's good.
These are volitional. These are responses of the
volition
will, not judgments.
Like
yeah. These are just movements of the will. See, this is where it gets tricky. In this column here, these are all movements of the will. We, when we do philosophy and speak with each other, we cannot but describe these using language. But they're not judgments or acts of language. They're acts of will. So this is the actual wishing. This is the actual, like, pursuit.
Okay.
Yeah.
If I can just ask you to, as we conclude here,
just say along the lines of what you were just explaining with respect to especially deliberation and consent, like
yeah.
just distinguishing, because it does seem like often we're talking about the will in intellectualist terms or intellectual terms. How would you describe what's happening there with, say, deliberation and consent? What is consent doing that's like deliberation or that's different, or
consent is sometimes described as acceptance of the means or acceptance of the batch that's available to you. So all I can do is say, do you know that that experience or movement you have within yourself? And you say, okay, you settle or accept this means, and you're not going to go looking for others. And then you proceed to decide, or you decide among that batch. So this is the acceptance, and then this would be a kind of acceptance of one particular means. Some Thomists have described election as giving one's heart to, giving the heart to the act, or giving the heart to the means. Where you have this, and then it's followed up by this, and so you have determined yourself this way.
Great. Let's give our thanks to Father James. We now have lunch downstairs, and it should be available just momentarily. Then we'll reassemble here at...